up in the hills. And everyone else was
sleeping. Just use his name.
It's fine. So we're sitting in the bed of, in lawn chairs in the bed of a truck, and we have a speaker going, and we're just kind of like bullshit and stuff. And so if you were like, imagine if you were in that situation and you got abducted.
In bed with another man?
No.
Abducted or abducted?
Technically that is a bed. It's the bed of a truck. Yeah. But no, if you got abducted. Wait, is it?
Abducted.
Abducted. Okay. If you got abducted, two of you like at the same time.
By aliens?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you each had like, you each had a different experience. Same aliens, different experience. So that way when they drop you back down, you can't even like corroborate each other's story. Yeah. There's no consistency. So you're both like, I swear to God, we were both abducted at the same time. They're like, well, what they look like? I'm like, well, they look like this. And he's like, no, they look like this. Okay, so a different thought process on that is if you got abducted just by yourself, the only thing they did to you was just like anal testing. Like you always hear like the like probing.
Yeah.
That's all they did to you.
That's how they know they don't exist.
And then you get put back. Is that something where do you tell people that?
Fuck no.
You're telling me that you could, knowing in your head and your heart that you have been abducted by aliens, but the only way you're going to be able to tell this story is by providing the only details in the story are that they did anal testing.
It's too much of a trope. Like it's just what everybody says. So could you imagine?
I don't think you could hold that in.
I think I could.
I'm not saying you're going on like the media circuit and doing all this, but
it's not a Springer type deal.
But I feel like at least you're telling almost everybody you meet that you're having conversations with. That's so rare. I think you have to tell, you just have to be the person going for the rest of your life being fingered by an alien.
I could take that. I could swallow that whole, because I know nobody's going to believe me. That's the thing. If there are no witnesses and there's a little butt play that happens, all I'm doing is copping to a fantasy that nobody's going to believe was ever real. What'd you lose?
I lost my pen.
It was in your ear.
No, not that. The better pen. Not the writing pen, the spoken pen.
Oh, the medical pen.
The one, the one that gives me my ideas. I'll find it in a second. Okay.
What? So you would just tell somebody immediately?
I don't think I'd tell them immediately, but I think that that's something that I'm like, I don't think that's something I could keep to myself. Because my whole part of the story was like, yeah, I'm having to tell this about me being abducted and like probed and stuff like that, but that would be the part of my story that I'm thinking about. It's just like, that's all people would hear. True. But my part of the story is like, no, like I'm just trying to like convey to you that this really happened.
I would leave out the probe part. That would be the one part of the story that I would just leave out. Cause like I say, as soon as I hear somebody's
what are you going to say though?
They abducted me. They ran tests on me. And then when they say tests, I don't know. I was out. All I was doing
then
was looking up
the lights.
Then you're not
going to know that they ran tests on you. You don't have enough detail in your story then.
Either way, nobody's going to believe it.
But I think just for your own satisfaction of you telling that, like, that's the true story of what happened.
Look, everybody else on the planet lives with some kind of deep, dark secret. And I'm pretty sure I could compartmentalize. There we go. Sword in the stone. Sword in the stone.
That's right.
I could swallow that. If anything, the only place I would talk about it would be like a therapist or something like that, where I'm going to say enough other shit where they're going to be like, hey, he lived through all this. Maybe aliens did abduct him and ran stuff on his butt.
You'd have to like, that's what I'm saying is like, you would be telling this to your therapist and you would be so adamant that this is true that you're like, what do you need from me to believe me?
I don't know how you prove that. I don't know. What was Ryan's answer? He told everybody?
Yes. I think we both agreed that we wouldn't be able to, we would just have to go through life as the people that got
I would just not want to be looked at weird because, like I say, every time somebody gets to that part of the store and they're like, and they
anally probe me. I know, but here's how many people have had something up their ass?
Fair amount. Medically, for funsies.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons to have stuff. That right there shouldn't be the stigma anymore. Is that no. part of the... That shouldn't be the part that people are paying attention to or anything like that in that story. It shouldn't be about that.
Yeah, it's just... It's a bridge too far. They took my blood. They did everything else. I'm not going that far with it.
Took my blood, checked my PUD.
Have you seen the Twitter video? I don't know if it's real or not, but it's the guy that was passed out asleep in his buddy's chair, and they put a fake dildo in his zipper.
Yes.
And then they wake him up, and as soon as...
Just at the moment when he takes the scissors and cuts it off. Yeah.
There's never been a more panic-stricken human being in the world, ever.
No, because like, it was literally wake up. The first thing you're looking at is the scissors held down by what appears to be a dick. I don't know if it even looks like... It didn't even look like the shade would be correct for him.
No, the shade was definitely not correct. But the simple fact
that he looked down, saw that there in the scissors, and it wasn't a long freak out because obviously he came to the realization quickly, but just that initial scream
he saw of what God he thought was going to happen. Point. Yes. Yeah. The anger that he had after that is... Totally justifiable. I totally get where he's coming from and why he would be that mad.
You know what? It's for situations like that that people need to have a code.
What do you mean?
Like, people need to have a code. Like a code of ethics that they live their life by. A code of honor, Adam.
I don't
like
know.
Like a Bushido code.
Oh, goddammit. Okay. Yeah, no, I agree. Code of honor. What would you call that? What do you think anybody not white would call that?
Is it Bushido?
That sounds right to me.
Is it?
Yeah.
And who lived by the Bushido code?
The samurai. And a lot of other people now.
So tell me about the samurai, Adam.
Pretty cool group. Well, there's a lot of, like, one way that they were great, one way that they were bad. They had just the craziest set of circumstances that they came about. And they, like, for lack of a better word, I would probably say, like, mercenaries is kind of the way that it felt. Just because they were always sort of hired guns to protect different people or
see,
to protect...
I was going to argue that with you until I actually just thought about what you meant by that. And yeah, like that's instead of like how you would think about mercenary today, I think where it's just like a gun for hire, You were for hire, but you were loyal, and it was for not just money, but it was for, you know, land and like stability for your family and everything.
Yeah. You're getting rice stipends. You're getting all sorts of stuff. You're being treated better than you would be. And everything about Japan, like we were kind of talking about it last night, like their culture and just all the different things that they do. It's so cool, but it is so confusing. And like the people traveling on mass transit nowadays, and they just don't make eye contact with people. Like in America, in big cities, you don't usually make eye contact with people on mass transit, But you do it because you're actively not, like, acknowledging that there's other people around. Like, you're the only one on the subway. You're trying
to acknowledge that you know that there's other people around. Yeah.
Like, you just basically want them to not bug you ever to the point to where you're, like, the only one. But in, like, Japan, when they're walking down the street or they're on subways, everybody always looks at the ground and looks at feet because for some reason, and I don't know what it is, and this could be not great to say, but... There's just something about, like, looking into somebody else's eyes over there that's kind of disrespectful. And stuff like that I don't understand. And learning more about samurai and kind of seeing where it all comes from, it makes a little bit more sense. Because it was a pretty war-riddled place for a really long time.
Well, I think pretty much any place was.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you think about, like, America, you know, prior to the frontier and everything. Yeah, it wasn't, like... the English coming over and fighting against the natives, but it was natives against natives. You had the different tribes fighting. So regardless of who, if it's going to be outsiders or people within the same country, you're still going to have fighting. It's just over resources. I mean, I think since people have been around, even like Neanderthals and everything like that, you have a better cave than I do. Let's try to go ahead and kick these guys out of their cave.
Yeah, and they thrived for a long time under something called feudalism, mm-hmm. which is like where you have your own feudal lands mm-hmm. and everything's broken up. And that's one reason that samurais did come around, because the people... Oh, boy, this is going to be the first word. We're going to see if we can nail this first one.
Okay.
The people that ran kind of the areas that were the feudal lords were called the daimyo.
Daimyo. Do you know what's crazy about that, too, is they use that term in Star Wars. In
Do they?
The new Boba Fett series. He's the daimyo of the city. So he's like, he's the one that like they pay, he's the one that provides protection, but they also pay him for that protection.
Okay.
So it just kind of goes in, like we're going to cover later, like how much of an inspiration that like this type of stuff had, even on modern culture.
Yeah. There's a lot of these words, like I was saying, you still see like, Bushido was the name of a pay-per-view that Pride FC, the Pride Fighting mm-hmm. Championships, the Japanese Mixed Martial Arts Federation, they used Bushido, like the code of honor, mm-hmm. as the names of some of their events that they had, just because those were the rules that they wanted.
Like, so many video games have been named like Bushido Code and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's the staying power is incredible. But these daimyos... would hire guns, and they were the samurai, and I want to say, I don't know exactly if so that's what samurai meant.
The daimyo were like comparing, I guess, to what we would have in the United States.
Like
the
a mayor?
What I'm saying is the daimyo, if you were going to compare it to like early United States, you would almost have it like mob bosses. And then they would have their underlings, and they would have, like, the samurai, who would be, like, their made men that kind of watched their area when they were gone and fought for them when they needed to, right?
Yeah, I don't know if samurai means to serve, but that was a word that they used. There was some translation to serve to make sure that the samurai knew, like, they were still underlings. They mm-hmm. were still just paid muscle, basically. The samurai, kind of before that happened, really got off right around the 8th century, I think is when it was. And they were sent to combat the northeastern, kind of like the, I don't want to say like the native people, but they were called the Amishi. And a lot of the people from the south were called the Yayoi. And they were people that migrated from Korea and China. And
the Yishi were?
The Yayoi were.
Okay.
The Imishi were like the people that were there first. They were up in the northern part, and I don't know what the migration pattern would be from Korea and China.
That's actually what I was going to look at right now, just to kind of see. Because I feel like, and I'm probably wrong on this, but I feel like just kind of in my mind's eye, I'm seeing that Japan is actually more south of Korea, so that I would think that people coming from Korea would go into northern Japan first, but I'm about to be proven wrong. Japan and go. Let's take a look.
You ever get confused when you look at a flat map and you see the United States and then you see Japan on the other side and don't remember that it circles back around and they're right next to each other?
Or that's what you always see when you think of the distance between the United States and Russia, because you're always thinking New York to Moscow.
Yeah, you got to cross the Atlantic to get there, but you don't.
You don't. You literally look at the Bering Strait and it's literally right across from us. But, you know. So, okay. So this explains everything you're saying. So it's almost like Korea and China are closest to South Japan.
So that must have been just the easiest way to travel up there.
It was like almost a straight shot across, yeah.
So the Yayoi coming from, I guess, more adapted cultures and more adapted people started to rule. And obviously the Imishi didn't like that as they were moving more northeast and starting to take over their lands. So the samurai, basically, before they were samurai, were just hired muscle to go up and clean up the Imishi. And they kind of started out as soldiers.
Were they natives to Japan, or were they members of the Yayoi people that migrated from Korea and China?
They were there before the Yayoi people got there. So
they had been like locals in the south of Japan.
I think they were just more up in the north, so I don't know where they came from as far as like how they got out to the island or anything.
Gotcha.
But they just kind of occupied that land, and as the Yayoi were moving up north, that's when they started getting into conflicts. And the Umeshi were kind of fascinating because they were really good on horses. Like they knew how to navigate a horse during a war or a fight, and the pre-samurai were just basically setting targets for them, and that's kind of what made them want to start training these sort of elite forces, because they had to learn how to ride horses too. They had to learn to shoot bows and arrows from there. They had to learn how to throw spears just on the run.
They basically saw all the ways that they were deficient militarily.
Mm-hmm. So it was a big learning curve to figure out how to defeat the Umeshi and take over that land. And it changed a lot of their kind of fighting techniques, as far as like when they would change their armor up, instead of being dudes that were like in heavily clad metal armor to try to defend, they knew that they had to be able to move faster so they weren't just kind of sitting tin can targets. Mm-hmm. And they changed over more to like a leather kind of armor, so it would be more flexible, they would be more movable. And one of the things that they would do on their helmets was, later on when samurai were kind of out for their own clout and kind of out to show off, they would literally like adorn their helmets in a special way. So if you were watching the like war, you could see which samurais were doing the most damage. But they also started to realize that if you were a samurai and you were in a war and you were trying to get away, they would also be able to see that you were the one running away from the action too. So they started to kind of get more basic with their designs, because they didn't want to be the guy that got called out for running away from the fighting. So after the Yayoi happened, samurai culture and kind of the way of the samurai, the training areas that they had, the gyms, came about like right around 1185 AD, so a long ass time ago. Another kind of vocab word that we'll use is a shogun, and it's a military dictator. They were usually appointed by the empire, or the emperor.
The empire.
Does Japan still have an emperor?
I think it's more of a ceremonial thing, kind of like it's, how England still has a queen and royal family.
But they still do have an emperor.
You know what?
I don't know.
Let's learn something.
Yeah.
Does Japan have...
So as these shoguns were the head of the military, they basically had all the power in the land. They were the ones that sat above the daimyo, and they would have basically power over everybody, to where they could rule larger factions of land and bigger groups of samurai and fight off all the other warring factions that were coming for them and trying to take them. And there was just changeover left and right. I mean, you would be in power for a little while, and then somebody bigger, better, and badder would show up and whoop your ass, and then you would become the new shogun.
I wonder if it kind of... And by the way, it does have... Japan does have an emperor still.
This is weird. We're doing this right after Abe got popped.
I know. Yeah, that's true.
Huh.
I wonder if...
intentional.
Yeah. In kind of like, you know, ancient... I don't know. Do you consider this ancient times? This doesn't seem ancient to me.
A lot of the words that I saw used to describe it were like medieval.
Okay.
Which seems weird to say medieval Japan. But
when
Japan,
you think about swords and armor, yeah, you kind of think of medieval like that. I wonder, with a lot of these like medieval places, the reason there was so much turnover is because, like, let's say there was a capital city and that's where the emperor ruled from, or whoever it was.
Kyoto.
What's it called?
Kyoto.
Oh, that's the capital. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you would have a strong force of like another country, or not country, but more of like a feudal territory, come in, overthrow the emperor, and then take over. Well, you just battled against somebody. You're weakened from the battle to take over, and now all of a sudden you have all these other feudal areas.
The next wave is on its way.
Yeah, the next guy's like, okay, we're at full strength. These guys are at half strength after beating the previous regime. We're going to go in. Same thing happens. So you get all this changeover because no one can stay strong enough to repel an attack. That's what I would do if I saw someone moving in. I was like, I'll take on the winner of that fight.
Yeah, wait for 2 weeks. Exactly. Let them settle their beef. Mm-hmm. And then if the side coming in is victorious.
Let their men get comfy and kind of relaxed. And yeah,
it's a hell of a strategy. Part of their daily life, just as samurai in these villages that they were around. This one's going to be tough. The weapons that they just basically carried around with them everywhere. They were called daishos, and it was the katana and the wakizashi.
Daisho
and
was the word for if you had two swords.
That's, right? I think, what it translates to, is just two swords.
I think what they said is that the only people at a certain point to be allowed to carry two swords were actual samurai.
And they had this rule called the Kirisute Gomen. Probably got that way wrong. But samurais had the right to kill people for doing anything that they deem like disrespectful.
Anybody lower in the caste system than them.
Yeah. So if you were like an artist or something like that, and you were walking through like the Saturday market, whatever they had back then, and you touched the samurai's sword and he wasn't cool with it, or you didn't apologize, he could just whip his sword out and cut your head off. And
they were pretty high up in the caste system.
Yeah. They were number three.
Yeah. So, I mean, They had that ability with a lot of people.
I don't know if they used it, you know, to their advantage, but that situation nowadays, I guess we kind of see it a little bit, but hopefully not as much as we see it on the news. But if you just let like random civilians that carried weapons around, like if you just disrespected them and they would get away with it, that would be a crazy hard place to live, because you just have to be like we were talking about, they don't make eye contact on the street. Is that something that's been ingrained for so long that you just like don't look at other people?
Did a samurai at some point take an affront to somebody lesser than them or lower in the castes than them, looking at them too long, killed them, and all of a sudden everyone adopted the position of don't look at them,
just stare at feet?
Yeah.
The two swords that we were talking about, the katana and the wakizashi, they carried the wakizashi just basically in the beginning as a measure of if they disrespected somebody, or if they disrespected their family, or if they did something terrible, they would use the wakizashi just to commit suicide. What's it called?
They did something.
Yeah.
Seppuku.
Seppuku. Yeah. So seppuku was just self-harm.
It was basically what it was is, and I might get this a little bit wrong, but the basic gist of seppuku, from my understanding, is that it allows them to at least try to retain part of their honor or gain some of their honor back by performing the act itself.
Which is kind of crazy, because in sumo wrestling for a long time now, thankfully, it's just ceremonial. But the referee in a sumo match will actually carry like a wakizashi now. And the only reason that they carry it is just for ceremony. But back in the day, if they were to like call a point wrong or call a match wrong or something like that, and everybody disagreed with it, they would walk to the center of the sumo circle and they would commit seppuku in front of everybody, and then just bring in a new referee. Like they took it that seriously.
Did you ever happen to John?
He missed that foot outside the ring. Yep,
missed the foot outside the ring. John's dead.
What happened? He had a seppuku. They gave him a Sapporo? No. He committed seppuku.
Seppuku.
The way that they had figured out how to make these swords was just Japanese swordsmithing in the world getting a little outside here.
Do you think that the katana? What do you think the most famous kind of sword is? If you like had people describe to you. Do you feel like it's like a medieval, like English sword?
Probably. Like as soon as I hear sword, I think sword in the stone, like something that was sort of
draw your sword.
Yeah, like a knight sword. I think.
But then, as soon as someone shows you a katana, you're like, "That's a sword."
Yeah, it's just badass. Oh, yeah,
that's a sword.
Well,
it's so cool that it's not known as a sword. It's when you say katana, you're just like, "Oh yeah."
The amount of time that they would put into these things, and one of the kind of cool things that they did learn from being able to ride on horseback is the reason a katana is curved is so you can pull it out of the scabbard easier when you're on horse.
Isn't the other reason, too, that if you have a curved sword, it's the reason, I think, why Arabic swords are curved so much. What do you call those ones?
There's a few different words for them. Oh, wow.
Anyway. The reason that those are curved is because when you're fighting on horseback and you go to slash at somebody, the curve allows the blade to keep kind of cutting traveling through along the body.
Yeah.
Instead of like a straight where it actually might just pull you off the horse. There's the curve that you're going to let the blade give a little bit with the blade, but it's also the curve is going to allow it to pass through the body.
Yep. And as a defensive mechanism, if you do have a curve and somebody goes to strike and catches the back of your blade, you have a little bit more power to be able to pull to see if you can disarm them.
Oh, okay.
The way that they were made, though, was really cool because, like we were talking about, they would take lesser metals and start cutting and folding them in with the actual strong sword steel that they would use. And it would allow them to be more flexible. So if you were out there and you were in a sword fight and somebody hit your sword, it would just bend instead of shatter. And one of the ways that they put the curvature in, besides just forging it in, is they would run clay up the back. And then when they would heat treat it to make it strong, they would do it face down, so blade down. And then as they would lift it up, since the back of it wasn't as hot because the clay would stop from being hot, it would actually naturally curve the metal back. So they could curve, I want to say there's some of them that they found that had like 4 to 5 inches of curve, which is just an insane amount of curve just to be natural. Able to. Yeah.
Just natural from the heating process. No, I think that's, I mean, that's, what's, how often is that the focus of movies or, you know, TV shows or something like that? Just, you know, the Kill Bill movies.
Yeah.
The
besides Uma Thurman, the katana.
Hanzo Hitachi or something like Hitachi Hanzo sword. And it was like the most well-known, well-revered swords. And
You see them everywhere. Just the history of what they used was something that is always just going to go on. I think we'll be watching movies like 50, 60 years from now, and you'll still see the same things. Like it'll be, I don't think history in the realm of like movies is ever going to stop.
No.
Because the further you get away from something, it's almost like the more interesting it is. Like, it almost becomes a storyline that you can do something with that people didn't know or realize.
It almost feels to the point, too, like something like this, it gets so sensationalized, too, that it almost feels like it's not real.
Yeah. There's a ton of different just fables, and I think they were called the 47 Ronin, were a group of samurais that their master had died, their daimyo, or their leader had died. And one of the things that they used to do was if your leader had died and you had failed him, they would all commit seppuku. But there were these 47 samurai that decided not to because they wanted to get revenge on the guy that killed their...
Yeah, he got assassinated. And so their failure technically would be the lack of ability to protect their daimyo.
Yeah.
So instead of that dishonor, first they decided to go ahead and kill the guy. And then if they lived, then they would do seppuku.
Well, they actually, instead of doing seppuku, they did sneak in, and this is all legend and lore. After they killed the guy, all 47 of them turned themselves in. So they turned themselves into the authorities or the guy's samurai, and then they were all led to the square, and they were all disemboweled and killed too.
Gotcha.
So I don't know how that story would live on without there being like some parts of it being true.
I think it's probably like a lot of like myths and legends is that there are, you know, as long as they're not just straight up ridiculous, I think there are inspirations, like true inspirations behind that. All the details might not have been correct, or some things might have been, you know, bumped up a little bit to make it more exciting. But how realistic is that? You have a daimyo that has a bunch of samurai, a rival daimyo kills him, and it's been established.
You're out for vengeance.
Well, yeah, and it's been established that the Ronin were, that was a real thing with the samurais. It was a samurai without a master. You got these 47 guys. How natural is that going to be to say, hey, they just killed our guy, we're just going to go kill their guy. That doesn't seem like a far-fetched
story. We'll fulfill our duties. Yeah. We'll turn ourselves in afterwards. Mm-hmm. We just want to get a little bit of revenge.
Yeah.
So they were all fairly, I don't know, disciplined, which going into the Bushido code again, this was something we're going to keep bringing it up, so we might as well just get to it. It was created by a shogun named Minamoto Yoritomo around 1616, so later on in their existence. But the Bushido code basically has 8 tenets. The first one's justice, the second one's courage, third one's mercy, fourth one's politeness, fifth one's honesty, honor, loyalty, and character. So kind of like everyday things that you would hope normal people would...
You want these guys to be the paragons of your society.
Yeah. You want them to be able to stand up for justice, mm-hmm. and to have the courage to fight, but to also have mercy on anybody that they thought was disrespecting them, mm-hmm. in public so they didn't chop your head off.
Well, these guys are an extension of you.
Yeah, they are.
Like, if you're the shogun and you want to, you know, you want people to love you, you're not going to order your... essentially your special forces units to go out and just act like a bunch of assholes.
Which I think they had a decent amount of power just being shoguns and having so many daimyo underneath them and so, mm-hmm. many other samurais. If there was some asshole that was acting up, they could probably take care of them pretty quick. Yeah. Especially when they enforce the Bushido code and say, if you're not living by this, we're just going to kill you. They had just some absolutely impressive wars, and I don't know if it's fantasy, I don't know if it's fiction, but, one of their biggest things that they had was an invasion by the Mongols, which was the Yuan dynasty, and it was 1274. The Mongols basically came over. They're like, hey, do you want to trade? Do you want to do some work together? We want to also inhabit this area too, so are you going to let us in? And the Japanese were like, nah, we're not doing that. This is our land. We fought hard enough for it. We're going to make this happen. So the Mongols were like, all right, we'll see how this goes. They ended up sending over 40,000 men and 900 ships, and they were only met by 10,000 samurai, which that's bad numbers. But somehow, magically, the world was on their side, and in the middle of the fighting, there was a bunch of thunderstorms, mm-hmm. and an alleged tsunami that came, and as the Mongol ships were all in port, they had tied them all together just basically to build like a little island out, yeah. there that they could go back to. Mm-hmm. The wind, water, everything kicks up. They end up smashing into each other, and there was only a few boats that survived. And so the Mongols just boarded those boats and went back. So the Japanese people almost felt like they had sort of like...
I read like it gave them like almost confirmation that their like home has, you know, their home was protecting them and that their purpose was divine, something like that.
Yeah, they had like a divine reason that they could never be defeated because, mm-hmm. of it. So that first one, I'm sure they're just, they have no doubt that they're the king dick around. They could take over anybody, or they could take out anybody that comes to try to take them over. They could run through whoever they needed to at that point.
Well, after that had happened, didn't, how do you pronounce it? It's Mongol.
The Yuan dynasty.
So the leader of the Yuan, dynasty in that time frame, because that was in 1274 when that happened, over the course of the next few years, he kept sending emissaries.
Yes. To the Japanese. This like is so awesome.
Like five at a time. And every single time he sent these groups of five guys, they would just get their heads chopped off and then sent back. And then literally he would just be like, all right, send five more guys.
Yeah.
Like, and he did it like two or three times.
When are you eventually like, hey, these dudes aren't coming back, but maybe they're getting beheaded over there. Maybe we need to actually come into some more conflict.
Yeah. Well, then in 1281, they figure, okay, we're going to go ahead and send more men. They send 140,000 men on 5,000 ships. And at this point, the samurai now that they're able to muster, number 40,000. Did you see the wall thing that they built too?
That was out in the harbor, yeah.
It was like the harbor wall, and it was like 12 miles or something like that. It's like, just land somewhere else, man. Like, they spent all this time building this wall. I guess also that because none of the Mongols were able to make it back because they kept beheading them all, they didn't know that they were even constructing this. So it was kind of going to be news to whoever you want was sending over.
Well, yeah, and you give them less of an area to land around the fighting, or you make them drive further around it in a boat. You got more chance to get off more arrow shots and just start attacking them before they can even make land. Which, luckily for them, somehow again, and there's a word that they'll end up using after this one that ties into American.
Is it
Japanese?
It's kamikaze, isn't it? Yeah. Flying wind. Yeah.
So, as the Mongols were trying to land, another typhoon comes out of nowhere, which, again, seems like great timing. I don't know if they just had typhoons every other day or what.
It's an island out in the Pacific, man. I would imagine, like, you'd never hear a lot about it, but I would imagine there's a fair bit of, like, storms or hurricanes. Think of Florida. Like, Florida deals
with, volcanic activity out there. Something to kind of push that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey. So another typhoon comes and just wiped out a ton of their ships to the point to where they were only landing so many that the samurai that were there, the 40,000 you were talking about, just basically had a field day with them. And so they pushed the Mongols back again, and they started believing in what they called the divine wind, which is what you were talking about, kamikaze, is what, what that means, is just divine wind.
That right there says something to me about that being part of Japanese culture. That this is probably very well known in Japan, is like, I don't know to what degree or what to compare it to, but if this is the point in which the Japanese really go ahead and become, you know, the Japanese, this was their kind of test for independence or their big battle test to see if they were going to stand as a nation. This is kind of like their revolution, their revolutionary war. So if like people learn about this type of stuff, this Mongol threat in Japan is their kind of like, this is our revolution, our version of the American Revolution. Then you would see the samurai being so revered in their country, but you would also see then the divine wind using that phrase kamikaze to try to inspire these people to just fly bombs into planes and die. Like, does that, am I thinking too deep into that? To you're asking, because the people that were kamikazes, they've gone back and looked at their journals and their letters they sent home. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to do that stuff. Some of them were fanatical enough to want to do it, but a lot of them, they had to get them, you know, drugged up, get them drunk, and they still didn't want to do it. So you're trying to do everything you can. You're like, hey, this is kamikaze. This is the divine wind. You're trying to like use your culture and like these big moments from your culture to try to inspire these guys to give their lives for their country.
I don't think it's overthinking it. I think it's just almost tough to talk about because we've never been to Japan. We've never been around there. I assume that their history classes are a lot like ours, where you learn about these certain different things that happened in ancient times in your country. And granted, they have a lot more history to go over.
Do you think they gloss over stuff like that they were on the wrong side of? Like,
I don't think they do.
You think that's just kind of a, because I'm not saying we do. We gloss over stuff that we
there's no question we do.
But what I'm saying is, you think other, I would like to think that other countries have more, what's the word? Is it integrity?
Yeah. Couth.
Yeah, that if you're willing to go ahead and learn so much about all the good that you've done and everything, that you do need to understand that it's not all good.
No.
That, like, a lot of the successes or things to be proud of about your country, but you probably have some dark shit in your past, too.
I don't doubt that they have a little bit more integrity, but I also do think they do look at things through more rose-colored glasses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how they teach World War II, but there's a good chance that they're like, yeah, you know, we did do this, but like there's still some justification.
I probably could explain what the justification, how they learn about it and be semi-close. I'm sure they don't learn about the, Bataan Death March all of the horrible shit that happened, like, to the Chinese, the atrocities that they committed against the Chinese and prisoners of war and everything. I could see a lot of that getting glossed over, and I could see the justification, you know, because if that's your country, you're never going to teach, you know, we were just flat out wrong and stupid and everything. You're going to be like, well, we ran into a situation in which we had open trade, and then because of us being on an island, not having as many resources, we had to then reach out and try to conquer new areas that we could conquer rightfully as part of our, but it was going to be for the good of everybody. We were going to make everyone prosperous, but we maybe just went about it the wrong way.
There's sort of justification for the attempt, I think, which in looking at this too, the fact that if you think World War II times, the 30s and everywhere in there, they're not too many generations away from the samurai being like fixtures in military battles and different things like that. Like the whole Order of the Samurai pretty much ended right around 1877.
Well, dude, like, have you seen like any officers, in the Japanese army in World War II, they all had katanas.
Yeah, it was all more ceremonial, and I'm sure if there was hand-to-hand fighting. But
it takes, how much of it takes inspiration from those from samurai culture?
Well, and that's what I'm saying. When you're being taught back then, and all those people, all those pilots that were in school back then, when they're hearing about history and samurai and all that stuff, they're being taught kamikaze. They're being basically,
but kamikaze told, in this sense, the divine wound meaning like defense of their homeland and everything like that.
And then when it pops up again during their military duties, they're immediately transported back to learning about all the people that came before them that committed kamikaze in a way that's sort of fantasized, that but part sounds of it. Good.
Yeah.
So I think that, not to justify anything that they did, but I think that they were probably told so much that kamikaze was a good thing that no matter what they did, they were still being divinely protected.
Yeah, there were a lot of situations, honestly, when they would give them, like, meth and everything before just to kind of dope them up and take them out of their own heads and be like, ships are that way.
How have we gone this far in society and seen, I guess we know that meth is bad, but where was the jump from it being used in wars and all these different things, because they were using meth, the Nazis were using meth and all that.
Oh, dude.
When do you think it got out to the public? Do you think it was like in Vietnam when people would be coming back from Vietnam and have heroin addictions for being over there, so then they started to see that there was a market? Like, do you think that the meth market came from...
I'm pretty sure that, I mean, I don't know where it originated. We're going to have to get back on topic after this.
Okay. I'm trying.
I know. I think probably what it was is meth, you know, or some variation of it was being supplied by the German military to its soldiers in order to power the Blitzkrieg.
Yeah.
That's how they were able to go ahead and, you know, overtake a country in like 4 days. It's because they weren't fucking sleeping. So how many of those people, though, that were being given this stimulant were then addicted to it for the rest of the war. Then after the war, then the people that weren't addicted to it, because post World War II, Germany was probably a pretty fucking depressing place.
Oh yeah. You Berlin, needed something to get through then the day. You were,
so I think it all just, it, I don't know. It's something that wasn't intended to be used like that. But I think it was just one of those things that people started using probably as an escape. Again, I don't know if exclusive to Germany or whatever, but
you think we could do separation and say if there was ever no war, there would be no methamphetamine?
There'd probably still be meth.
Yeah, we would have found it somehow.
Yeah. All right, so they end up kicking the Mongols out, secure victory. Then in 1967...
14.
Oh, four, sorry.
A few years back.
1467, Yoshimitsu, the shogun, falls, sparking decades of clan warfare over ruling power. So, Yoshimitsu, he's the shogun at this time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, at this point, though, what happens if a shogun dies or something happens? Doesn't a new one get appointed by the emperor, or does such chaos happen after a shogun passes that you can actually have the transition of power, like between different emperors?
This is sort of around the time, and I skipped a little bit of sort of how different things would work with as far as how the emperors came into power, because there were a lot of people, or not a lot of people, but a lot of emperors that realized they didn't want to rule just because it was such a big undertaking to have people taking shots at you all the time to try to knock you off your throne, that they would retire pretty young. And as they would retire, they would try to have their hand in choosing new shoguns so they would be able to live a lavish life, but still have like kind of like a control of the area
like a puppet.
From afar. Yeah. Puppet's a great example. So there were a lot of old emperors that would step into these positions of saying, we want you next. We're going to go chill. We're going to go get rubbed down with whatever the Japanese equivalent of olive oil was. Mm-hmm. But we want you to lead. And Yoshimasa had a very large empire, and he was basically held in pretty high regard by the rest of the former shoguns and emperors, or not shoguns, but he was held in high regard by the other emperors because he was the emperor's choice to be that shogun. Gotcha. So he was basically like their choice by proxy.
Okay.
So after he falls, it's just back to clan warfare again.
So basically he was the one running everything. So if he falls, the emperor's not going to know enough of what's going on to actually hold everything together.
The emperor's going to be overthrown. Everything's going to go back to just banana land again, where everybody's fighting for the throne again. So they go through that for a decent period of time, almost 100 years. And then we end up starting to see kind of the first string to be pulled from the armor of the samurai lore. In 1543, the Portuguese landed on an island that was called Tanegashima. And that was basically like the Japanese first introduction into firearms. They had a good idea of like blasting powder and gunpowder before that because they were still in contact with China.
Yeah, and I think the Mongols, didn't they use like
they used bombs.
Like, yeah, small, like the few. I imagine that they would look like a miniature version of like the cartoonish bomb you see, like a small black ball with a fuse on the end that you light and just chuck.
Yeah, for some reason I see coconut with a fuse out of it.
There you go.
And that could be, I have no idea what they were made of, but that would scare the living shit out of me.
I think they'd probably seen at this point maybe cannons or had heard of cannons. I mean, there's a big difference.
They were so
between
cut off from everybody. I think they knew, like I said, gunpowder, blow up, do that kind of thing. But I don't think they'd seen cannons before.
Okay.
Because just in their area, I don't know what the Chinese would be using, but they were never at war with them. They were kind of like China Junior at that point because they'd emigrated from there where China wasn't trying to take over them yet. In
God,
history.
Don't they hate each other now?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of bad blood. It's tough to have like a democracy type that close to a communist country,
that's
I think.
True. Yeah.
Especially when you're from what is now the communist country. So, but
I think some people in China just look at it and they're like, fuck Party Island.
I bet they would have so much fun there. Like, that would, I feel like if you sent a bunch of people over to Japan from China and they would come back, they'd start a revolution, which would
they
be squashed out immediately.
They're like, we're just going to stay here.
Yeah. We're good. They probably would never go back. But the introduction of guns kind of flails right in the face of the samurai way because the samurai felt that the guns kind of threatened everything that they had built. Like, it would take you 10 years to go through a samurai school to learn horse techniques, to learn hand-to-hand combat.
It's a shortcut to winning something.
Yeah. You could pull some asshole off the street and give him a week with a flintlock pistol and teach him how to shoot, and all of a sudden he's the most important person on the battlefield.
A samurai that's been training his whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no matter what you say, a guy with a sword is, or a guy with a bow and arrow or a sword is never going to be as effective as a guy with a flintlock pistol.
No.
Like, it's just the way that it is. Before 1543, they said that the majority of deaths that would happen on a battlefield, bow and arrow. After 1543, the majority of deaths that would happen on a battlefield, pistol.
Gotcha.
So just that much of a world-changing event for them.
Well, isn't that the entire, the entire plot of The Last Samurai?
Yeah, I'm just not a big Tom Cruise fan, but
I think I've seen it all the way through maybe twice, which I actually had a realization too about it, is that at first I thought the movie was called The Last Samurai because it was like Tom Cruise is the last samurai, and I felt that that was really just a stretch. Like, really? You're getting called, this guy's going to be the last samurai? After rewatching the movie or thinking about what it was about, it's about the last samurai. So samurai is one of those words where it's like duck or like deer or moose.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, those are deer. And it can cover a lot of them. So what it was saying, this is a movie about the last of the samurai.
Well, and his character, correct me if I'm wrong, because I think I've only seen it once, but we'll get to it kind of towards the end. But a guy named Saigo Takamori, is that?
I can't remember the names. I remember his name is like Colonel Williams. I don't know. Anyway, he gets hired over there. He's a washout from, like, the, what would they call it, the Continental Army.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, so not even close then. Because Saigo was an actual Japanese guy.
No, so this guy is brought over to teach. He's hired by the Japanese government and the emperor to teach his army how to use guns.
We just whitewashed the fuck out of this.
I know.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, he gets brought over to teach the Japanese military how to use guns, cannons. They had, I think, Gatling guns. So this was after... He actually might have been someone in the South. And okay. Then after the Civil War, they lost. He went over to Japan to earn money and train soldiers to use the weapons now.
Keep getting his bloodlust on.
Yeah. So he ends up getting captured by... one of, like, the last either daimyos or samurai clans in Japan, and lives with them and learns their ways, of course, falling in love along the way. And he gets to then fight at the end as a samurai.
Huh. Yeah, that we'll get to kind of what they actually consider the last samurai, that Saigo guy that I, or Saigo that I was talking about.
Sorry, Tom, it ain't you.
Yeah, no. Probably fit the same height parameter, though.
Probably.
Yeah, he's right in there. So, at that point with the samurai feeling like their jobs are sort of being threatened, you still have the clan warfare and the feudalism going on where people are knocking each other off left and right. And we actually run into another sort of mythical thing that I thought was all bullshit until I learned about it. But during the Sengoku period, which was just a time after... It's kind of like the time after they had had guns.
Okay.
There was a new type of soldier that showed up. And that new type of soldier was better than a samurai, in my opinion, at that point. They were called shinobis. And that was actually what we consider now ninjas, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, it was kind of cool to read about that, that, like, the samurai and the ninja actually had, like, a clan-type rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they weren't real pumped about it because samurais were very deceptive and worked at night a lot of the times and were sneaking past all these samurai to get to the...
You just said the samurai did that.
Or, so the sorry, ninja the ninjas.
Yes, they used a lot of deception, so they felt that it wasn't honorable.
Yeah, they didn't think that they were had a position or a place on the battlefield because they were just basically sneaks and spies that would go in.
And assassins.
Yeah.
And, yep.
Which I think is kind of sweet. Like, the fact that ninjas were actually something that existed and not just some overly used phrase that people try to talk about for being sneaky. Like, there was...
They didn't even think about that. They associated with knowing, like, karate or something. Yeah. Like, I'm a ninja. Like, no, it's like full on the first part of Batman Begins.
Yeah.
That's ninja.
Okay,
sneaky,
yeah.
Sneaky, deception. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's... In a way, they still served a purpose because they were going through and they were assassinating all these different leaders, these different factions. And I don't know. I think everybody probably kind of had them in their groups and in their clans because they did serve a good purpose. I don't think it was just the ruling class or the actual shogun that had them that was going out and knocking people off.
Well, and one thing, too, about, like, the samurai is that... kind of part of the samurai culture was being well-rounded in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that they were so respected for and that they held in such high esteem is that they weren't just warriors, you know, masters of the sword and everything. They were taught to be, you know, statesmen or what you would consider statesmen. They were well-educated and very literate.
Bureaucrats.
Yep. They learned about farming and, like, working the land. They learned about the arts, like a lot of things about, they would like practice like calligraphy and like do rock gardens and all of this. They had a belief that to be, you know, the best samurai, you had to have no weaknesses.
Yep.
Like in your game.
You had to be well-rounded.
You have to be well-rounded and everything worked in harmony to where your ability to work in the rock garden balanced your, you know, whatever you would consider Zen or Qi. Cause it wasn't the religion at this point. It was a, like, one of the religions that they really followed was it Buddhism?
Buddhism showed up, and it kind of snuck around or stuck around, but kind of ended up being quashed
out
too.
Like, it was kind of like Buddhism and Confucianism, and it was trying to think kind of what.
Yeah, this is going to get to me because Shinto.
Okay.
Coexists between various sects of Buddhism, Christianity, and some ancient shamanistic practices. Nailed shamanistic.
So they took a little bit of everything about those three or four things and kind of made it their own, but
still kind of polytheistic instead of just believing in one god, because if you're going to believe the divine winds came from somewhere.
But I mean, the samurai had been around for so long and was such an ingrained part of Japanese culture, like from the inception of like when Japan was just kind of getting its legs under it, that, you know, these people that were from these, and again, these samurai families, aren't they hereditary?
A lot of them are. There were a lot of people that were down below in the caste system that tried to move their way up to try to get into some of the upper echelons, because it sounds like if you were kind of below that, like if you were below a samurai, shit started getting real bad real quick. Like peasants were considered more noble than fucking artisans.
Yeah.
And luckily, magicians were down at the bottom of the totem pole, which they should be in really any aspect of life, because it's just disgusting.
They're just like ninjas. They're deceptive.
Yeah, true. But like artisans, like ceramics work, the only way that you would get any kind of shine if you were like somebody that made pottery or anything like that would be if the emperor's family would take a liking to the designs that you made. That would be the only way that you would be able to like really make a living. Yeah.
It's like when you see fucking influencer wearing like a boutique shirt and they're like, oh my God, look at this. And it somehow gets popular like that.
Yeah. All you need is one dumb tween talking shit about how great your stuff is and then you blow up.
But like the samurai were very revered as like sources of wisdom as well. They were very well respected. And so kind of a lot of them were even like politicians, or like politicians to a degree where they would have influence over whoever was ruling, you know, in that area. A lot of the emperors would have certain, you know, samurai within, not within their court, but that they would go to for advice, like well-respected people.
And during this time, a lot of what we're talking about comes kind of right around the corner from where we are in the timeline. There were three guys that showed up as they were considered the three great unifiers of Japan. And these are just their last names. Nobunaga, Hideyoshi, and
Ieyasu.
Yeah, Ieyasu, I think is what it is. And it's shitty because that's the most important one. But they really tried to push the envelope to start to unify Japan and to get away from feudalism. And that happened right around 1568. And their main goal was just to basically subdue all the daimyos that were causing the trouble and the issues so they could have kind of one ruling class. And I want to say Nobunaga ended up becoming the shogun, and then Ieyasu and Ieyasu were his kind of two right-hand men. Once they finally did become unified, it started to cause issues again with the samurai. This was kind of like the next string to get pulled, because they started getting away from samurai being able to carry weapons out on the street. They started to put that stuff away. They started to put the guns away. They tried to basically sort of push back on, we don't need this violence in our culture. Mm-hmm. We want everybody to be harmonious. We don't want people carrying swords around that could potentially cut your head off for doing something stupid. Mm-hmm. And they weren't really big fans of that. And then we run into 1600, right on the nuts, somewhere around October. There was a battle of the Sekigahara, which broke out between the Toyotomi loyalists and the Ieyasu forces, which the Ieyasu forces, basically, the first two guys, Nobunaga and Hideyoshi.
Who was Tokugawa?
I believe he was just a daimyo that had enough. He wanted to go back to the old ways. He wanted to be
basically someone that's against the current regime.
Yeah.
Whatever you call it.
Yeah, it was just a military government that wanted basically to get their power.
Gotcha. Okay.
Wanted to take it wanted to bring it back to what it was before the Great Unifiers were about. And so that was just another battle that was huge, to the point to where there were 40,000 samurai that were killed on the first day. 40,000 casualties in a day is just insane.
Well, and you figure out what the firearm weapons had evolved to at this point, because again, if you know the Portuguese are have access to firearms back in 1543, and now this is 1600 on the dot.
Yeah, so they bought a few of them from the Portuguese, and then basically reverse engineered them and started making them left and right, because they knew the Portuguese showing up, the Mongols showing up, there was going to be an invasion that just kept coming. They kind of saw that knocking on the door. That's embarrassing. So Tokugawa Ieyasu, the guy that was in charge of it, ended up winning, and he was just basically took over as the ruling class from the guys that they were fighting against, because some of them, the Toyotomi, were sort of holdouts from the first two.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as Ieyasu, God damn it.
Are you starting to go ahead and have these words blend together?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of vowels in Japanese words, and they pop up next to each other and just everywhere.
Right, so Ieyasu, his forces end up winning. Now, does he actually become, at this point, like, do they reinstate an emperor, or is the shogun pretty much just going to be considered the emperor at this point?
The shogun is the emperor, or not the emperor. The emperors basically are just in name now.
Okay.
They don't do anything. They're kind of just
the fanciful queen. It's fellas. The queen mother at this
exactly,
point.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. It's Queen Elizabeth at this point.
Okay.
So to try to get this back on track, because I just completely fucked up and butchered that last little bit. Once Ieyasu finally gets in charge, like we were talking about, this is off the rails for me.
Okay, I think I can put this together for
you. Yeah, give me like 30 seconds here to bring it back.
So, Ieyasu's name was Tokugawa Ieyasu. The opposing forces that challenged them were the Toyotomi loyalists.
And Toyotomi was one of the other unifiers?
No, the unifiers were
Nobunaga and Hideyoshi.
Hideyoshi. So okay. Toyotomi is just this other guy causing trouble.
Okay.
I think we're back on. So the Toyotomi loyalists.
Do you ever just blank?
Yes.
Completely just
there's
gonzo?
There's several times that are on this podcast in which I just pause and go, wait, how did I get here? Or like, where am I at? Or I forgot my thoughts. So trust me, yours will come back to you in about 3 minutes. This is all going to come back around. And you're just going to go, wait, stop.
This is one of the great pitfalls of doing a high podcast, is sometimes you just blank out. Sometimes
occupational hazard, man.
Yeah, that's what it is.
This is the price of the podcast.
Yeah, the rigors that we put ourselves through to give you guys a semi-listable podcast is...
See, the error that was made here is on the board. Toyotomi and Tokugawa are right above and below each other.
Yeah.
So when you're reading the lines, it looks like your eyes can get drawn to it. So there were 40,000 soldiers dead on the first day. So Tokugawa Ieyasu's forces there. They end up beating back Toyotomi's loyalists, and the Ieyasu kind of dynasty, or his kind of time begins then at that point.
And at that point, now we're back. We're online again.
So the Tokugawa shogun of Japan, it ruled from like 1603 until 1868.
Yeah, just a long-ass rule.
Yeah.
And during that rule, the samurai sort of became more, like you were talking about, like more governmental officials. They weren't involved in fighting anymore because... Mm. Ieyasu had taken over everything that
it makes sense too, because if you have an empire that you're making or creating and you need to have somebody in these areas who knows how to rule subjects on your behalf, kind of ruling as your representative, there's not going to be anyone better than the samurai to do this, because they're already, you know, trained as statesmen. Mm-hmm. They already know the lands in which they're going to be looking over.
They're in position to...
People have already probably looked up to them in those areas. So you just have, you know, it's kind of an automatic built-in almost form of government for, you know, like representational government without being representational government. You have people in place, like an infrastructure of ruling, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
And at this point in time is when a lot of the samurai start to dabble, like we were talking about in other things, as far as like they would start martial arts schools. Mm-hmm. It would be times of teaching instead of times of war, because they still had all of their training and everything. Mm-hmm. And they were still being trained the way that they
were. Part of their culture was to pass on that knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now they could just pass it on in almost different ways, rather than having to worry about wartime. They had this, you know, pretty extensive period of peace. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were insurrections during this time that had to be squashed and everything, but it nothing seems like...
Nothing couldn't be stuffed out.
Yeah, there was no way. Type of, like, there was no type of change to the ruling class.
Yeah. So while all that is happening, we finally get to 1852, and Matthew Perry, not the guy... Not our Matthew Perry.
Not Chandler?
No.
Okay.
Was he Chandler?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I know him as Luke Perry's dad, and Luke Perry's a is that right?
Nope.
No. Okay. So I was way wrong, because Luke Perry is the wrestler's dad.
Luke Perry's
Jack the... Perry.
Okay.
Jungle Boy.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, not Luke Perry, Matthew Perry.
Matthew Perry, no relation.
Too many. Okay, so it's not a Wilson situation. It's not Owen and Luke.
No.
Okay. That's right. Matthew Perry was in Almost Heroes, huh?
Chris Farley.
Him and Farley.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like the Lewis to Farley's Clark or some crap like that. That's right.
So Matthew Perry shows up with an American steamship, and the Japanese see them coming off the coast, and they automatically just think that the steamship is on fire, mm-hmm. because all they see is this black smoke billowing from these ships.
In their defense, anytime they'd ever seen a ship with smoke around it previously, it was on fire. Yeah, it was a wooden ship on fire. It wasn't good.
They didn't know what steam power mm-hmm. was. They didn't know about steel ships or anything like that. So the Americans roll into town, as we have a tendency to do.
Fuck, think, like, the Americans got a steamship to Japan, like, over open ocean.
Yeah, in 1852, so, like, not real deep into America.
No.
They were just kind of, we'd figured it out. I assume that they probably had to have sailed from
California. Well, I mean, we already had a ton. Like, yeah, 1852,
California had to be a part of
America. I would imagine, but still, that would mean, like, let's see, Matthew Perry, and I know it's going to pull up the
fucking... They have to go deep.
Let's see, I need to do when they say it's go to Matthew Perry disambiguation.
What is that?
It's when you, like, put in something on Wikipedia, and yeah, I am using Wikipedia. You put in something, and, like, Matthew Perry. The first thing it pulls up is Friends Matthew Perry, because it's so popular. You can then click under and it says Matthew Perry disambiguation. And basically what it means is it's going to show you then all the forms of Matthew Perry.
No shit.
So it'll show Matthew Perry. So this is Matthew C. Perry, American naval officer who forcibly opened Japan to trade with the West. Boom.
Yeah.
He is not a handsome man. He would have been frightening.
Hey, and we're out of Pride Month, so you can say that.
He would have been frightening to look at, and his uniform was very ill-fitting. No, but I'm wondering, so if his expedition to... He was assigned in 1852, a mission by Millard Fillmore. God, that is...
Millie. It's a bad name.
I was going to say Millie Philly. He was actually going to force the opening of Japanese ports to American trade. Like, hey, we're going to send in a gunboat because you're going to trade with us.
Yeah, well, and these people hadn't seen a steel ship. They thought it was fucking on fire.
No, but does that sound like the way you get someone to trade with you? That's how you go take shit. You just, like, blow through it with a steel boat. You don't, like, break through and be like, we have stuff for you. You have stuff for us. Let's do business.
You don't think they had a bunch of, shit on the ship.
They Kool-Aid manned the freaking harbor with the ship. And then they were like, oh, yeah, let's trade. Let's see, where did he...
He would have had to have left from California. There's no other way, because I don't know if the Panama Canal was a thing yet. I don't know.
He embarked from Norfolk, Virginia.
What the fuck?
In command of the East India Squadron in pursuit of a Japanese trade treaty.
So we're learning in real time.
He chose the paddle wheel steam frigate Mississippi as his flagship. Made ports of calls in Madeira, St. Helena, Cape Town. Dude, he went the other direction.
So he went around South Africa to get there?
Yes.
Holy shit.
God, he went the other way? What is this? What does the Mississippi look like? It's a paddle wheel steamship. So it's basically, oh, okay, I like this.
Looks like a riverboat?
No. Remember, like, you don't see him at all that often, but when you do see him, it's the paddle wheels on the side. It's a sailboat with the paddle wheels on the side of it.
It's like a seap? Like a...
So it looks like a sailboat.
A boat plane,
almost. Not really. I mean, the paddle wheels aren't huge, but... I mean, here, you can kind of see.
No shit.
So, like, just imagine, like, a big sailboat that you're familiar with, like, you know, and on each side of it, you have, like, a skinnier paddle wheel, like you would see on the back of a riverboat, but they're on both sides. I wonder what the purpose of the paddle wheel... I guess it was just another form of power instead of a propeller, because that's what it was, right?
Yeah, it's the only form of power that they had back at that point.
So they used a combination of wind and the paddle wheels to get him over there. But anyway, so he ends up getting over there to force a trade treaty.
To force a treaty sounds like mm-hmm.
the... Sign this shit!
That's the American way. So at that point, one of the old kind of OG, not super far back, but one of the guys that really longed for the samurai way, Saigo Takamori, who during his time, instead of sticking around in the capital, went back and was kind of a sword maker of sorts, is what he called himself.
Mm-hmm.
Basically was anti, like, I don't want to deal with any sort of trade. I don't want... Basically, you're fucking things up at this point. Like, mm-hmm. We're gonna attack. We're gonna try to bring this back to where we were before. He wanted to go back in time, basically, to...
He wanted more of a Japanese traditionalist, I guess is what you would kind of call it.
And that's a good way to put it.
Thought that probably, especially after the situation involving opening up trade with, you know, trade treaties and everything, he probably thought that they were straying too far from tradition.
Yeah, yeah. Tradition.
I think there was some talk about how there had been like this 250-year-old policy of national seclusion that Japan had had.
The Yan era or something?
Yeah, but it was 250 years in which they were, seclusionist.
Which would have been 1600 to when this mm-hmm. was happening, right around then. So he led something that was called the Satsuma Rebellion, which was... just did not last very long at all, because it was traditionalist samurai against a group of people in the Miyishi Empire that ruled Japan
mm-hmm.
that was very happy to use guns in a fight against a bunch of fellows with swords, and just completely wiped them out. And Takamori is basically like the what they consider the last samurai. That's last samurai for being in Japan was Takamori. So that basically effectively ended. The samurai was the last Satsuma Rebellion.
So at that point, it kind of gets relegated to what they considered the last, probably true hereditary type samurai, like trying
the last stand.
Yeah, because I'm sure, soldier. There are still samurai families. But they had probably let that heritage kind of fall into the past.
In name more than in practice.
Yeah. Well, especially as now that there's not really a purpose of the samurai at this point, how often do things stay relevant when there's not really a purpose to them? At this point now, Japan has started to open up trade. All of these jobs are now available, to make a ton of money. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of these like samurai families being higher standing families, like if you go and you look at some of the more wealthier high class like Japanese families, I bet a lot of them can probably tie their ancestry back to families that have them rooted in samurai.
Well, you could assume too that a lot of the Japanese military nowadays probably formed from samurai families,
or were trained, yeah, or you know, the policy in which the military follows, or the, you know, the way that they're structured was based upon command structure was based upon samurai, whatnot. It, like I'm saying, like back in World War II, officers carried samurai swords and committed seppuku if, you know, if they dishonored or they failed in their missions. There was a huge, huge emphasis on, I don't know if you would call it pride of country, loyalty, or like honor, that if they felt they dishonored themselves, the emperor, their country at all, the only option was to take their own lives.
Would you consider having a self-defense force, like a standing army?
I don't know. Is the term army exclusive to being able to both wage like offensive and defensive capabilities? Is that what an army is considered?
I feel like it would be, because just to have basically like defenses trained at home, if you're not,
that kind of seems like going offensive. Back to kind of what we talked about on a previous podcast. So like the Trojans during the whole Trojan War weren't an offensive army, but they were considered an army.
Oh,
what?
This is something. Under the post-war constitution of World War II, Japan is not allowed to have an offensive military force. And Article 9 declares the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. So Japan technically doesn't have a standing army. They just have defense forces.
So they're probably allowed in a lot of those treaties. The ones that are actually withheld now or like upheld now, they allow you based on land size, population, to have a certain number of ships. You can have like, just guys, kind of as an example, post, I think, World War One Germany, they were able to do certain things militarily. Like they could actually, maybe they couldn't do anything militarily. There was something that they could do is they could have like air clubs for pilots, but they couldn't be military, so they would like train on like civilian aircraft.
Yeah.
They could have certain number of ships. I want to say tonnage. Like you could have one aircraft carrier, two battleships. And I don't think that was, I'm probably wrong in saying that that was after World War One. That might have been something to where like that was part of a different treaty.
I would assume it would have had to have been World War One, because they realized that.
Yeah, but after World War One, I don't think that the Treaty of Versailles was after World War II. No, Treaty of Versailles was after World War I. That's the one that Hitler was just like, what is this? No, fuck it. Yeah, that they kept just letting him get away with. Yeah, so I don't think that one allowed Germany to have any type of military, and then they just started rebuilding it, and everyone just sat around on their thumbs and were like, hey, don't do that. Please. Please stop building tanks. Okay.
It's so funny to me to think about that and just think about like you're having a, after you lose a war, you have to sit there and have a discussion like you're a child and they're the parents.
Dude,
and
that was just, I'm almost completely convinced that that was just like global denial. Like they had just come off of literally the worst world conflict that anybody could ever remember in the history of the world. Millions and millions of people dead. Famine, families torn, like lands just completely destroyed.
Yeah.
They're literally coming off of World War One, and all of a sudden they see some like fucking crazy person again in Germany.
Didn't learn their lesson.
And it's not even that. It's just, I think at the point that like everyone that was trying to uphold the Treaty of Versailles or enforce it were just like, this can't be happening. There's, we can't do this right now.
There's no way we're doing like, this again. Yeah,
come on. This guy's not serious. And so it was just almost a denial of being like, we just literally got done with something like this. There's no way someone's doing this again. So that's why they just let it happen and happen. And then surprise.
Well, in Japan after World War II, when everybody in all the axis of power were like, hey, no military for you. They're probably like, okay. We realize that we might have overstepped our boundaries in the first time that we tried this. We're okay with just not having a standing army. Like, yeah,
They don't need to even have an army at this point because they're so relied upon for technology and other like types of services that only they are like extremely good at.
They got big brothers.
Yeah, they not only have big brothers, but people won't fuck with them just for the simple fact that they need them.
That's a good thing to have. I mean, it's
to have loyalty based on not on fear, but because people need you. Yeah, I'd rather have that.
Yeah. Because you're not going to be relied upon to do the fighting. You're going to be relied upon to make the things.
Make the things that they put the explosives in and then travel over and kill everybody. You're the ones that designed that tiny little microchip that tell this bomb where to go to make sure it hits its target. You're the most important part.
You're still pulling your weight.
So some things that I was kind of thinking about were, I think I was talking to you last night about this. I thought that katanas weighed like quite a bit more.
Yeah.
Swords in general just weighed quite a bit more, but 2 to 3 pounds. I don't know if I just like don't understand how swinging around 2 to 3 pounds, how like tiring that might be. Cause I mean, it's 2 to 3 pounds stretched over the course of lengthwise and everything. So you're getting, you know, you're holding onto one side of it. You've got, you know, most of the weight above your hands trying to control that. So maybe it is a little tougher than I'm thinking, but just saying 2 to 3 pounds does not sound like much.
It's when you're talking about swords, the best way that I can relate it to is like when you hold onto a softball bat, like mm-hmm. that softball bat right there, it's 27 ounces.
Yeah.
So it's going to be under 2 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But when you are dealing with swords, and the length coming out,
mm-hmm.
part of the factor in is what's called the pommel, which is underneath the handle.
Yeah.
And to have a balanced sword, you're going to want to have a pommel that's heavy enough for when you swing it and your recoil to come back,
mm-hmm.
you have enough weight underneath to where you're not going to swing all the way through something and lose control because it's heavier at the tip.
So because it's kind of like a counterweight. So your hand is a little ways up on the palm, but you want enough weight essentially below your hand
mm-hmm.
that it's helping to move that. Kind of like the train thing, how it's got the weight on the back, but the train thing.
Or like a crane.
Yes. Okay, and that makes sense.
So when you have that, you're going to have 1 to 2 pounds at the front, but when you have handles, which on katanas initially before they really figured out that you could have two swords out at the same time, mm-hmm. it was a two-handed weapon. So you had enough in the handle to where it was heavy enough when you would slash through something, the recoil to pull it back, it wouldn't be as heavy in the tip mm-hmm. because there was still weight in the handle. So 2 to 3 pounds, you're thinking of maybe 1 to 2 pounds of actual steel in front and then enough counterbalance with the handle in the back to be able to move quickly through things. And like we were talking about last night, when you look at like a claymore or something that's bigger that was a two-handed weapon,
mm-hmm.
they always have fat pommels at the bottom because they have to figure out how to counterweight all the mass that's in the blade.
I can't remember the name of it, but the samurai had an equivalent to the claymore. It was just a big fucking katana.
Yeah. Whoa.
So some of the other stuffs that, you know, just from samurai culture, kind of backtracking a little bit, is that, you know, it wasn't just for these men. Women didn't necessarily fight on the front lines with the samurai, but they were also taught to defend themselves and to defend their families and all of these skills because you would have the men
Otokachi
gone fighting for these daimyos and everything.
Otokachi was the big dog.
Otokachi was the big dog. What was it that the women used that the, it was the stick with almost like the blade on the end of it? It wasn't a spear.
Naginata.
Yes.
Which is where Naginta comes from, which is
from the league. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just remember what it was.
A Naginata was a weapon that they would use mostly from horseback just because you would have mm-hmm. the range to be able to use it. But it was a weapon where basically it's still hand to hand combat, but you had a range to where it was going to be longer.
Why when they would teach women to fight, they would teach them with that because it kept them out of swiping range with an actual katana. And they were able to go ahead and have that advantage of a little bit of a reach mm-hmm. to, depending on who they were going to be fighting against.
Well, in the earlier days too, they actually did, like when they go through and they see these old ancient battle sites, mm-hmm. they were finding remains of females that were in armor out on the battlefield. So they were still, they sent women out to fight on the front lines in a way, but not in the same numbers that they would send the men out.
Yeah.
And a lot of the samurai wives that were in the families would be trained as a home defense in case somebody were to attack the home while the samurais were away.
Mm-hmm.
So there was still an understanding that the females did have a role in kind of like the samurai order, sort of, but they weren't considered samurai. It's a different word.
So while you're looking that up, so probably the most famous samurai that's known, his name is Miyamoto Musashi.
This guy is a bad ass
dude. So basically he's considered a swordsman, and not just a swordsman, he's considered a kensai. They have a thing called the Sword Saint. So he's considered a kensai, a sword saint of Japan. That's just so badass. You're so good at something. You're the saint.
Well, and this was country. This was the dude that was killing people with the wooden practice swords, wasn't yes. it? Yeah.
So he was a swordsman, philosopher, strategist, writer, and ronin, who became renowned through stories. He had this unique double-bladed swordsmanship. He had an undefeated record in his 61 duels. The next closest to him is 33.
So he was the first guy to introduce using two swords the on dual the battlefield. Swords. To use a wakizashi along with his katana. Mm-hmm. So to take both hands off of the katana and know that he's going to have a second weapon that nobody's going to be able to defend against.
He wrote a book called The Book of Five Rings, which is kind of an art of war type book. A lot of philosophy about, you know, strategy, using your weaknesses as mm-hmm. your strengths, things like that. And I think the last match that he had was against like his like arch rival. And it was
the guy that killed his dad.
Was it really?
Yeah.
And he had, it was with wooden swords. So it wasn't like a lot of his victories. When I say like his duels, these duels were like with wooden swords.
Into submission. But there were times when he was cracking people in the head with the wooden practice swords yes. and still killing them.
Yeah. Yeah, these things aren't like soft. Like no. you could like
it's like getting hit with a smaller baseball
this is
bat.
This is a sword saint of Japan. He could kill you with anything.
Yep.
He'll kill you with a pine cone. But yeah, I'm trying to think of what the guy's name was that was his
rival.
Yeah. It was like the greatest duel that he had had, and I can't remember what it was.
So while you're looking that up, earlier on in his career, he had run into a guy that was basically like the head samurai of this other clan and ended up smoking him and killing him with just a single blow to the basically top of the head mm-hmm. with a wooden sword and killed him. And the guy that he killed's younger brother steps up and says, "You're not going to go ahead and defeat our clan. You took out our guy. I'm going to take you out." He steps up and he cared so little about this fight, the guy that you're talking about, the sword saint.
Musashi.
Yeah, Musashi. Musashi showed up late to the duel and basically said, "Hey, you're wasting my time. Let's just get this over with. I'm going to show up." So he ends up killing Musashi with an actual blade because they were going to fight to the death. And after Musashi wins that one, the third family member, the third brother, steps up. This kid was like 12 years old. A 12-year-old, and they say, "He wants to fight you. We're going to duel to the death. You're going to show up at night to do this." And Musashi realizes that normally duels don't happen at night, so he thinks that there's something kind of up and funky.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the story gets kind of fanatical. But Musashi actually showed up a few hours early to kind of scope things out and see what was going on, because he thought there was some fishy stuff going on.
Like, "Oh, you want to meet at night? Okay."
Yeah. So he shows up and sees that this 12-year-old is surrounded by a bunch of archers and a bunch of other samurai that were hiding. Musashi supposedly sneaks down out of the mountains, cuts the 12-year-old's head off, then continues to fight the other samurai and gets out unscathed from the archers that were standing around. So he didn't get shot by one arrow, but just completely wiped out this entire samurai family. The guy is just the stuff of legends. Like, a lot of this seems like it's stretched, but Musashi is a guy who, he's kind of like their Achilles. He's just their champion.
So I think this guy's name is Sasaki Kojiro. And he is, so he was Miyamoto Musashi's arch rival. And
the guy that killed his dad.
Let's see. So his battle with Musashi where Sakaka was killed. Yep.
It's, the stories are so cool.
So what would, I was trying to figure out what the American equivalent of samurai would be. And the only thing I come up with is the cowboys. But like,
you think?
Yeah. Like what would you think would be, you know, something in our past that is, and I'm not thinking of comparing them like their roles in our culture or society. What I'm saying is their relevance. So like if when people think, if you really just think of like Japan, what's one of the first things if people were to think about Japan and you were to show them images of Japan, samurai would have to be top three images. Yeah, if you're trying to go and explain go
first.
Okay, or if you're just showing someone images and you're asking them what country, identify this country. You show someone a samurai, you're like, that's Japan.
Yep.
You show someone a cowboy, United American. States. But what I'm trying to like get at here is, look how much like history and culture like the samurai have. The cowboys were just like a bunch of freaking like bandits with syphilis, just riding around on fucking horses, robbing everything.
I think it's just an element of time. I mean, the samurai started building in the 8th century, so they had.
But isn't that like a perfect representation of kind of it feels like the two countries. One of them feels like the Wild Wild West with all these cowboys running around doing just whatever the fuck they want. Then you have, you know, that's the big thing that people always think about with Japan anyway, is it's very structured. It's very about the, I feel like, especially with their, you know, you always see like in Japan, like people wearing like masks. They wear them when they're sick as like an unselfish way to keep other people from getting sick.
It's disrespectful in their culture.
It's a very courteous culture. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have a courteous culture.
No, the closest I think I can get just with like the fact that they were kind of hired guns would be like the Secret Service. I think the Secret Service is a highly trained group of individuals meant to defend higher, like a daimyo, like a politician.
In more of an independent kind of thought process, maybe like a private military contractor.
Yeah.
Because you're, you know, like you were saying with the samurai, they're not necessarily guns for hire, but they're loyal to a daimyo.
They're loyal to who pays them.
Correct. And so it doesn't necessarily have to be the emperor or the shogun, because you had other daimyos that tried to go and overthrow them. They had so samurai with them.
There's not really a national
I don't think there's a comparison. I just think it's just crazy that that's all I could think of was just the freaking cowboys.
Well, and they were just kind of lawless too. They had their own, the Bushido that mm-hmm. they had to stay loyal to, but beyond that, they could do whatever they wanted.
That's one thing too that I read is it's like, you know, there is the, you know, like with everything, there's a romanticized version
mm-hmm.
of this kind of stuff where people see samurai and they think, you know, the honor, the code and everything. But they do realize that with anything, there is going to be bad apples. You know, you're going to have outliers that are criminals, that are samurai, or that are ruthless, that are samurai and kill just because they have the ability to kill.
Well, and unfortunately, what I was thinking earlier that I stopped myself from saying was like the police force.
Yeah.
Not all of them are bad. They
have power over the public.
They serve their mm-hmm. purpose. Some of them.
They're meant to inspire people.
Yeah.
To be, you know, to be the, I know I said this before, but like to be the paragons of society. You want to feel safe and everything, but they still do have this weird kind of control over you that does make you, can make you fearful.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not a great example, but I think it's kind of the most on the nose. Because they are, you have municipal police forces, you have city police forces, mm-hmm. you have sheriff's offices. There's people that are given a higher platform to serve under a daimyo type mayor, mm-hmm. something like that.
One of the craziest things about this is that they came from, you know, Japan geographically is not large.
No, not at all.
No.
It's shockingly small.
So the fact that this part of their culture has had such like a huge impact in some ways that people don't even know about, you know, on the outside world, and how many things that we kind of look at that are inspired essentially by either the samurai themselves or samurai culture. You know, how many of our, just going to the Bushido, that's basically a code of conduct. Every military now has a code of conduct.
Yeah. Yeah, they have their own courts for it.
Yeah, they're not militias. They're not lawless or anything like that. There are rules and there is a code of conduct. So that in itself right there, any military that has a code of conduct worldwide is going to owe some type of like inspiration to the samurai for that. As far as just like even like pop culture and everything. So, you know, Star Wars was inspired by the samurai. So there was a movie essentially made called The Hidden Fortress, and it was about a, I don't know if it was brothers, but they are hired to like escort this princess along this dangerous road.
And this is Star Wars?
No, this is The Hidden Fortress.
Okay.
But it's confusing because now you explained that, like, yes, you have two heroes. You have Luke Skywalker and Han Solo, two guys escorting a princess down a dangerous road, rescuing Princess Leia, taking her off the Death Star.
Oh, okay. So the Secret Fortress is Japanese lore?
Yes. Yeah, so The Hidden Fortress was a Japanese movie inspired by samurai, because the characters in that movie are samurai. Mm. Samurai being hired to escort this princess. So the inspiration from that is what George Lucas took and made into Star Wars. And then you have, you know, the lightsaber, which is essentially a laser katana.
Slices through anything.
Mm-hmm.
Good you recoil.
The Jedi are a cast of basically warrior monks.
Isn't Jedi Japanese? Isn't the actual word?
It sounds like it. If you were to say that word and it had no actual meaning, there wasn't any connotation or meaning to it, I would say it's a Japanese word.
I believe that.
But I mean, you had this entire, you know, now when you look back on it and you look, watch those movies, you're like, oh yeah, that's definitely. Have you ever heard of a movie? A lot of people make reference to it. The Seven Samurai.
That's an old one, isn't it?
Yeah. So the original Seven Samurai was pretty old, but what it basically established was, it was like the first like team up, like assemble a crew for like a mission type movie, kind of like the 47 Ronin you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How they were, you know, together to. The Seven Samurai is basically a movie about these seven samurai that go, I believe they're like hired by a village that is being terrorized by like another group. And these seven samurai, I believe they're seven Ronin, are collected together to form a team to protect these people. Okay. And so think of any movie, The Magnificent Seven, that's based on the Seven Samurai. Any movie that you see having like a team up was inadvertently...
Yeah.
Inspired by this legend in Japan about these, you know, seven samurai in this movie. So there's just a lot of stuff that gets pulled from this culture. And I'm really trying to think think of like how often you see like, of course it's going to stand out to you right now because you literally just spent, like you said, you feel like you spent two weeks in Japan because you've been watching so much stuff. But put... That excluded. Think of how much you do see, I think, like Japanese or like samurai influenced stuff, either on TV or, you know, if you're reading a magazine or looking online or something like that. Is there anything like that kind of exists in that same way? I mean, we still see cowboy culture here because it's part of our culture. You still see cowboy hats, cowboy boots, all that kind of stuff, but not like traditional, like Wild Wild West cowboys. But I'm just trying to think if there's been like a group of individuals or kind of like a sect of people in a country that have had like, because there's something very just like appealing about, what is it? What's so appealing? Like, what's so cool about samurai? Is it a combination of everything? Is it the fucking swords, the martial arts, the fact they're smart, the cool armor, the battle, like what is it?
I think it's the lore. It's just the abilities that they have and the stories that we hear about them. I think a little bit of it is kind of like, you know, you heard about like the ghost of Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know or care to find out if it was true or not, because it's an awesome story that I think brought a lot of hope to Ukrainian people. The ghost of Kiev.
Very inspiring, yeah.
Yeah. Was taking down motherfuckers left and right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that kind of thought process of these legends that come out of it. And a shitty version of it today that I would say would probably be all the people that don't want to serve in the military, but still want to wear like military themed shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like you get the people that wear the shirts that have the flags on the arms and have all these catchy sayings mm-hmm. about don't touch my guns and all that shit. I think there's an air of the side of people that wanted to be like in the military, but couldn't be, but still wanted to make it sort of.
They don't want the obligation to do it. They just want all the benefits of being like, oh, I just want the fun part of it without anyone telling me what to do.
Yeah. And I think that that's a probably not the same thing when you talk about samurai, because the discipline culture that they were in and just kind of that, I don't think there's a lot of misappropriation to like job titles in Japan. Like there's mm-hmm. not a lot of people. Stolen valor, I don't think is a thing in Japan.
No.
So I don't think that it's that.
It's too honorable of a society.
Yeah. You just wouldn't think of doing
like shame,
that.
Like shame of family. It's so crazy to me how much like I guess like if I was to go ahead and shame somebody, I wouldn't be worried about like my lineage, like my family line.
No,
I'd be worried about the shame that I brought to those people that I care about that are close to me, that being even inside and outside of my family. But like family prestige and honor, like in those Japanese cult, you know, those Japanese families is just, it's huge.
Well, and I think part of it is, we have this weird thing where we are a large country, but we're a large country that's so spread out that
we're not spread enough sometimes.
No, not enough. But you're talking about a small island that has 125 million people on it and that dense of an area.
Yeah.
So yeah. Family and lineage is going to mean a lot more when you're living in a village that only has a certain amount of people in it that all live so close. Whereas us, I mean, if we fuck up bad enough, you could probably just move to another state and like it wouldn't bring shame and honor, or wouldn't
you could
bring
probably move like
to your family.
You could move just a couple cities away most likely and never run into anybody or never have that shame follow you.
No, yeah, there's so many options for us to go to, whereas 125 million people on an island, you have to it's going to follow you wherever you go.
They're just, they seem like they're just good at so much, so many things, like Wagyu.
Yeah, it's,
you've got it down to a science where you're just breeding the most delicious. You can't eat a ton of it.
No.
But just the most delicious. And it's horrible how they get the cows like that.
Well,
but man, it is delicious.
I mean, they let them graze whenever they want.
Yeah,
they
but
feed
like,
them
really
beer.
Think about it. Like
they massage that, them.
I know, but really think about like how much like if you look at a piece of like prime like crazy expensive Wagyu, it almost looks more fat than muscle.
It's so beautifully
marbled. I know it is, but like to me, looking at it not from a standpoint of getting ready to eat that steak, but from a standpoint of like, is that animal like functional? Like you have that much fat within the muscle. Like if you imagine if you cut into a person and you saw that much fat and that little muscle, you'd be like, this motherfucker is fat.
That guy lived a cush life.
That guy didn't do shit. I know, but if it was anything else, that would not be appealing. It's something about they figured out that cow that they were just like, we can somehow just get this thing fat and fucking delicious.
Well, and you're not thinking about the end game. You're not thinking about like a geriatric cow. You're not thinking about an old cow because he's got an expiration date all the time.
I guess not.
A human. Plus, if you think about it too, the fact that the Japanese want to go that extra mile to create something so delicious mm-hmm. by painstakingly taking care of
like
such
sushi.
Animals.
Sushi's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
You don't like sushi?
Raw meat just isn't appealing to me.
I guess it depends. I have my levels of sushi. I like, you know, there's probably people out there that like the strips, what do you call that? Like sashimi, where it's actually the strips of fish. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a roll person. Like, I don't mind the raw fish. I'm a roll person. But I guess that's what I mean. But, like, it's delicious.
You're not looking for the uni, the roe, the eggs that are sitting on top of things?
I don't mind that a little bit on top of roll. I'm not, like, an eel sauce person. Like, the names of some of this stuff, I'm sure it's delicious. But you got to make it more appealing for the name.
That's Americanizing that shit.
I know, but like, figure out a different name, like eel sauce. Like, do you think an eel sounds appetizing? And I definitely don't want it. I don't want wherever the sauce is coming out of it.
You're also, America is such a culture of, to put it bluntly and probably not really well, waste. Like, over there, when you're creating a ramen and you're trying to build a broth or anything, this has gone into food talk real quick.
Ramen over there isn't ramen here. They're a completely different thing.
When you're constructing a broth, you're using bones, you're using tendons, you're putting everything that we don't eat into that broth to make it flavorful. And the cultures over there, more in Chinese food culture than Japanese food culture, but you're eating like tendons and you're eating the gristly parts that we throw away and that we discard here. You're eating that.
Yeah, but at the same time, like the tendons and everything like that, gristle might be disgusting. How much of that shit actually gets processed into what we're shoving in our faces every day?
Oh, if it's a sausage, it's fine because it's eatable.
Yeah, or a processed patty of something.
True. Yeah, but it's a culture where they don't waste everything. They take so much pride in everything, they don't waste it. When you're, like, I cook a lot of my beef in tallow because it's just beef fat.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, to me, in my brain, I think, what's going to be the best way to cook this? Probably with everything else that was in the cow. But I'm not going to think about intestines or anything like that because those are things that don't seem
edible. Not a real nose to tail.
No.
Yeah. No. Me neither. All right. Well, what do you think?
I think samurais have been going over.
I think we're samurai'd out.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for listening again, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Peace.
All right, guys. Hey, thank you so much for making it through another episode and sticking with us. If you want to kind of follow up on the next upcoming episodes, get some teasers, Adam, can they get us on the Twitter?
You can get us on the Twitter. Our Twitter handle is Historically High. That's Historically H-I.
Nice. And on the Instagram?
Our Instagram is Historically High Pod. That's Historically High P-O-D.
And what happens if you're social media inept?
If you have any issues where you can't figure out social media, our email is historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com.
We set up a landline.
Just in case.
You guys can go ahead and shoot us any questions, comments, or even maybe suggestions for future episodes, something you guys want to hear.
Yeah, high thoughts, questions, anything like that. We're always open. We'll always get back to you.
Hell yeah, guys. See you on the next episode.
Peace.